Hi, I'm Connor Friedersdorf, a staff writer at The Atlantic Magazine.
I'm Sarah Posner, senior editor at Religion Dispatches.
And we're going to be talking today about the Democratic Convention that is just concluding in Charlotte, or I guess has already concluded in Charlotte as we tape this, and maybe contrast it to the Republicans. And I was going to get us started by referencing a post that I wrote about Joe Biden's speech, which he gave last night. And I thought that it was generally a perfectly fine speech. I'm a fan of Joe Biden and his earnest demeanor. And there was one thing, however, that bothered me about his speech, and that was when he was talking about Osama bin Laden, and he was trying to contrast the difference between the approach that candidate Barack Obama had taken in 2008 and then subsequently followed through on as president, that he would go into Pakistan if necessary to get bin Laden. And then what Mitt Romney said back in 2008, which was that he didn't think that Obama should be basically talking out loud about getting bin Laden. And more to the point that Romney said something to the effect of, it's not worth spending billions of dollars and moving heaven and earth to get one guy. In other words, you know, of course he would get bin Laden if possible, but he wasn't going to reorient all of American foreign policy around it. And Biden took issue with that, and his argument was twofold. One part of his argument was that it's important that we send the signal that when someone attacks America, when someone kills thousands of Americans, we're going to hunt them down to the ends of the earth. And I actually think that that's a perfectly defensible point, that we want to send that signal, just as in the criminal justice system, we don't do a cost-benefit analysis every time that there's a murder. Well, is it really worth it to get this guy? We have this notion that justice and future credibility demands that we go after everyone who commits a murder. And I think it's, you know, basically the same thing with bin Laden and national security. But the other thing that Biden said that I really disagreed with was that he attacked Mitt Romney and said that what Obama understood was that America's heart had a wound in it and that it needed to be healed, and that only by killing bin Laden could we heal the wound in our heart. And that's one of the reasons why it was important to, as he put it, move heaven and earth in order to get bin Laden. I just thought that it was really creepy to me, actually, because this notion that a kind of bloodlust, that putting a bullet in Osama bin Laden's corpse is somehow going to heal America's heart or heal the wound that we got from 9/11. I just think that's not how humanity works, and it kind of draws on some really dark impulses in humanity. At least that was my reaction.
Yeah, you know, I read your piece this morning. I was interested in that because I'm always looking at, because I write about religion and I write about religion and politics, I'm always looking at the conventions through that lens and thinking about what the parties are and the candidates and their supporters are trying to say, because they're definitely, both parties are trying to say something religious or say something to appeal to religious voters. They do it in different ways, but they're both parties are definitely doing that. And I thought that that particular statement was very sort of an eye for an eye kind of justice, right? But which was very different from the religious message that the Democrats were otherwise trying to convey, which was very much, you know, sort of we're all our brothers and sisters keepers and we have a responsibility to look out for each other. And not that those two things have over the course of history been incompatible with each other. I mean, like, I think societies have adopted this eye for an eye alongside looking after their brothers and sisters. But I just thought it was part of the Democrats were doing two things this year, maybe not as strenuously as they have in the past couple of election cycles, but they were very robustly trying to prove that they were tough on terrorists. Yeah. And very robustly trying to prove that they were religious. And I think that it wasn't weren't necessarily compatible ideas, that the sort of retribution that they were seeking, the eye for an eye justice that they were seeking by killing Osama bin Laden, and not just killing him, but gloating about it repeatedly at the convention, didn't, to me, jibe with the religious message that they were overall trying to convey.
Right. You know, I mean, I totally agree that they were invoking this notion of an eye for an eye, but that isn't actually what I think that Biden's comments went beyond that. In mm-hmm. other words, that's not what bothered me about Biden's comments. It wasn't that he was invoking an eye for an eye notion of justice. It was that he was making a statement beyond justice, and he was saying
that it was going to heal their hearts, right?
Yeah, beyond the fact that justice demands this, this is also a precondition of America healing, right? And I think that on one hand, that gives terrorists too much power, right? If Osama bin Laden lived in a cave for the next 40 years, would America just have a hole in its heart that whole time and be unable to recover? I don't think so. I think we're a much stronger and more robust country than that. And also this notion that killing someone, even killing someone justly, and I think that the bin Laden killing was just, that's somehow going to heal your heart. That certainly goes against a sort of New Testament notion of what heals the heart. It's certainly at odds with forgive your enemy. But I would just say that what heals your heart after a terrible thing, whether you're an individual, I don't know how well the heart metaphor maps onto a nation, but insofar as his speech forces us to use it, what heals the heart is time. What heals the heart is forgiveness. What heals the heart is grace. These are the things that heals the heart, not killing someone, mm-hmm. even if justice demands that you kill the person. And I think it's important to distinguish between justice and keeping us safe on the one hand, which are legitimate things to do, and healing on the other hand. And if we're looking to continually heal ourselves by killing the people that are attacking us, I don't think we're going to succeed in doing it.
And I think he did say in very Joe Biden-esque way that it would literally heal the hearts, right?
Yeah, he did say literally.
But I guess, I think the vice president's speech is obviously viewed as being a lot less important than the president's speech or the incumbent president's speech or presidential right. nominee's speech. I think the real speech that stole the show, if it wasn't Michelle Obama's speech, it was Bill Clinton's speech.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I really enjoyed Bill Clinton's speech, not because I agreed with all of it, but because it isn't that often that I feel like a politician is speaking to the nation as if we're intelligent people mm-hmm. who are able to understand at least reasonably complex ideas and perhaps open to persuasion and trying to persuade. And I like that he was trying to persuade.
Yeah, and I think that he, like you said, he took on substantive policy issues, the policy issues that are at the forefront of voters' minds, the economy. And I think he did a really good job at not attacking the Republicans in an ad hominem way, but mm-hmm. demonstrating that their obstructionism would stand in the way of implementing economic policies that are going to benefit voters. And I think the way that he did it was surprisingly, maybe not surprisingly, but it was very hard-hitting and specific, but like I said, not in an ad hominem way. And it almost made you forget that Bill Clinton was the consummate triangulator when he was president. Which I thought was right. A pretty pretty masterful stroke there.
Yeah, I think that he has always been very adept at explaining relatively involved and complicated policy things in relatively simple language.
Yep.
But my colleague Jim Fallows wrote a post about his piece that I almost felt like he beat me to it, because after I read it, I thought, man, that's exactly what I wanted to say. And he basically was talking about all of the moments in Clinton's speech where he would say things like, now, wait a minute, pay attention. This is complicated, but it's important. Or now I want you to get this just right. And in addition to the substance of the speech being you know, partly explaining relatively complicated things to voters. He was signaling that, that's what I'm doing, that I'm not talking down to you. I'm speaking to you as equals, and I'm trying to explain this thing that I understand, that I want you to understand, and that's really important. And you know, I'm sure that there's been a lot of talk of fact-checking lately in the blogosphere, and I'm sure that if you went and fact-checked Bill Clinton's speech, there would be some things that turned out to be a little bit off or a little bit misleading. I do think, however, that for the most part, he gave an accurate characterization, albeit from a Democratic perspective, of the different policy debates. I think that he was within the realm of generally honest political speech in what he was saying, in a way that
there wasn't a Janesville GM plant moment in his speech.
Yeah, I mean, I would say there wasn't a
Right.
It was one of the other attacks, one of the other Romney Ryan attacks that most bothered me, much more than the James one, but I don't remember what it was at the moment. But yeah, I mean, I think generally that there was no attack that struck me as beyond the pale.
Mm-hmm.
And so I enjoyed that too. I would say actually, after watching the RNC and the DNC, aside from Bill Clinton, who I think really stole the show, it was striking to me that a lot of the best performances were turned in by female speakers, and especially by Ann Romney and Hillary Clinton. I don't know if you enjoyed both of their addresses. Michelle Obama, yeah.
Right.
I think that Michelle Obama and Ann Romney both did really phenomenal jobs at addressing their respective conventions.
Well, in very different ways, I thought. I thought that they presented themselves as very different people, very different first ladies. I think Ann Romney would be a very different first lady than Michelle Obama is. And I say that knowing that first ladies are constrained in their role.
Right.
You know, Michelle Obama used to be a lawyer, and now her signature issue as first lady is a very important, but obviously not deep, intensive policy, you know, the healthy eating and obesity and exercise sorts of issues. But I think that both of them, they discussed their relationships with their husbands, their devotion to their husbands, their devotion to their children, and they both had to do that. I mean, it's, you know, I think that the women have to do that in a way that, you know, men don't have to. You know, they don't have to, men and don't have to talk about how much they love their kids and that their number one job and the most important job is being a dad. You're not going to hear a man say that. And I wonder if you'd even hear a man say that if he was not running for president, but his wife was running for president.
Yeah, it'll be interesting when we have a female president who is married to hear how her husband navigates these issues.
Because right.
It definitely won't be exactly the same.
I would find it really surprising, refreshing maybe, but surprising if there was a male potential first husband, first dude, whatever they would call it,
mm-hmm.
and who would go to the lengths that women have to establish that really, really the most important job I have is being a mom. Don't worry, I'm not one of these women who values her profession more than her children. And it's kind of, it's not, you know, it's like, I mean, obviously everybody should value their family above anything else.
Right.
And so that it sort of implies that women aren't allowed to be really pumped up and psyched about their careers. And so it really bothers me that's what they have to do. And Ann Romney, I think, took it in a more conservative view of motherhood direction than Michelle Obama did, because, you know, she even made the joke about Mitt Romney being her sixth child, and, you know, like, haha, that's supposed to be funny that the guy is so, like, helpless and not helpful around the house that it's actually like having another kid around. And, you know,
yeah.
I found that sort of just kind of, you know, I would love to see our society and our politics move beyond that sort of thing.
I thought that, I thought that they definitely kind of tapped into different ideas about gender roles and the relationship between husband and wife, although both well within the realm of sort of traditional American notions of these things.
Yeah, they were both very safe in that way.
And I also thought that, one thing that was interesting to me, I spent a lot of time in the convention hall in the hours before the speeches, just going around and speaking to delegates.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just ask them, where are you from? How did you get involved in politics? And a lot of times I would be speaking to a delegate sitting next to their spouse. And on many occasions when I would talk to a female delegate, and this is true at both the Republican and the Democratic conventions, there would be times when I'd be speaking to a female delegate whose husband was there as a guest, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them were local officials. One was a state legislator. But actually, the way that their husbands talked were sort of like the way that the first ladies speak or prospective first ladies speak, in that, they didn't talk about how their first role was to husband their kids. In fact, they were mostly older people whose kids were probably grown if they had kids. But they would say, oh, I'm just here supporting my wife. You know, she got involved in this. Man, is she smart. She knows all about these things, that kind of thing. So I'm curious to see if that's how it goes one day when there's a female president, or if there's some cultural expectation that I am not quite tuned into that is going to dictate how that particular person is framed.
Yeah, I think it's going to be fascinating. If, as some people are speculating now, that first female presidential candidate is Hillary Clinton, that'll be really interesting because, her husband, is sort of unusual in terms of his professional
right,
success.
Yeah. I mean, that would almost be sui generis. It wouldn't help. We'd have to wait for the next one.
Right, right.
Did you find yourself disarmed by the speeches of the candidates' wives?
No, I didn't find myself disarmed. I thought that Ann Romney's speech was, don't be surprised, I found it to be very religious. I mean, I think that the Mormon culture that they got married in and grew up in very much sees motherhood in its sort of divine role of preparing souls for the afterlife, and that, motherhood has this special place in their religion. And I think that in a not obvious or hitting you over the head way, but I could hear that in her speech. I felt like that played a really important role for her in her speech. And I don't know. I mean, I think that that's still true within Mormonism. I think that's these sort of traditional gender roles are still there. But at the same time, there's a vibrant feminist Mormon community which has been challenging those gender roles, including the refusal to ordain women or let women not ordain
right.
because there's a lay clergy, but let women serve in the same sort of role that Mitt Romney served as a lay bishop in his church in Boston. And so I wondered whether there was a generation or a culture of Mormons out there who looked at that a little skeptically or with a little bit of a jaundiced eye, just because that's something that they that they're challenging within their faith.
That's interesting.
Michelle Obama's speech I thought was just fantastic. I think she's just such an amazing natural speaker, and so I just thought she was fantastic. I think that Obama during 2008 campaign got so much attention for being the great speechmaker and the great orator, and she completely showed him up at this convention. I mean, his speech was very workmanlike last night, and hers was soaring and inspiring, and I just thought that was kind of funny because I wonder if it was a little bit by design because they had gotten so much negativity about him being just a great orator and no substance there, even though
I don't know
if that was true, but
I enjoyed
if they pulled back a little bit because of that criticism.
I enjoyed both speeches, both Michelle Obama's speech and Ann Romney's speech. I thought that they both came off as very impressive women and very likable. And I guess my reaction to them was actually that I was almost a little bit uncomfortable with how disarmed I was, because I think that for good reason, the spouses of candidates occupy this role in our minds where they're kind of beyond attacking in a way. There's a norm against attacking them in the same way that you would attack a candidate because, right, you know, they haven't chosen to be there. And I think that there's a good reason for that. I think if we attack them like we attack candidates, lots of good people would never be able to run for office because their spouse would say,
I'm not going to go through that. May have been an exception to that.
Yeah, she was an exception. And I think because she, and legitimately so, in a way, because she played such a major policy role in her husband's administration, that she almost had to be a part of that conversation.
But I think there were also, in addition to that, that raising questions about her policy role with regard to healthcare reform, I think that there were also a lot of very mean-spirited personal attacks on her. And there have been on Michelle Obama as well.
And actually on Chelsea Clinton as well, yes, in a way that the Bush daughters and Obama's daughters thankfully haven't faced.
Right.
But I don't know. I think that although I don't want that norm to go away of not attacking spouses in these vicious ways, I also think that Ann Romney and Michelle Obama are kind of taking advantage of that apolitical status to do a very political thing at these conventions. And that makes me a little bit uncomfortable. And I also think, you know, Ann Romney and Michelle Obama are both very well-spoken, eloquent people who are, also very charismatic and physically attractive and just, you know, all of these things. And surely there's some spouse of a politician or a prospective politician who's thinking, you know, I'm not a good public speaker or I'm not particularly physically attractive or, you know, one thing or another. And I don't know if we want the voice of the spouse playing a significant role in our presidential elections. I sort of think that maybe we'd be better off if the spouse, whether male or female, was just actually part of the family and not going around and making televised speeches.
Well, I think that is a reason why some people don't run, because their spouse doesn't want to do that. And their spouse doesn't want to be in the spotlight, and their spouse doesn't want to give speeches and be scrutinized and all the rest. And I don't know that I have an issue with the spouses being political. I just have a question about whether it's a little bit just of a show of, my husband's the greatest guy. I'm going to tell you all these wonderful things about my husband. And it's just after a while, it's sort of kind of, well, of course you're married to him. Of course you're going to think he's fabulous, I hope. So it just seems like a silly exercise more than a politicized one.
Yeah. And I mean, if you think about the public trying to use the spouses to figure out, you know, I think that there's a trap you fall into where you're trying to figure out, oh, who is the real Mitt Romney? Who is the real Barack Obama? And of course, their wives surely have insight into this. But I think if there's one thing we know about public figures, right, it's that their wives, whether deliberately or not deliberately, will mislead us, right, about who they really are.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that this, you know, Hillary Clinton during Bill Clinton's sex scandal was not a good guide if you were trying to figure out what actually happened, nor was Elizabeth Edwards during her husband's sex scandal. And, you know, and I don't want to compare those two. I don't want to say that there's an analogy between those two and this next thing I'm going to mention. But, you know, another public event recently, you know, like Jerry Sandusky and his wife still defending him, right? We just know that spouses, for a good reason, are not a good guide to the truth about someone.
Well, they're,
especially
they're
the controversial or negative things.
Right?
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
You know, the at the Republican convention, I think that there was a lot of effort to humanize Romney, because I think that the criticism was, well, we don't really know who he is as a person, and he's so robotic, and he's been so flip-floppy on on some of the issues, and so we don't really know who is this guy. We don't know anything about his character. We don't know what he really stands for. And Ann Romney was a character witness, but you know, obviously your spouse is not necessarily a reliable or trustworthy character witness in the sense that, well, not trustworthy, but you know, obviously there's a bias. She's going to say something really nice about you. But the folks from Romney's church in Boston were also brought out for that. And what I thought was interesting about that was it was supposed to tell you Romney really is a caring, empathetic guy, despite what how he comes across on the campaign trail, or despite what you've heard about Bain, or you know, liking to fire people, which it's you know, that speaking of fact checking, that got taken out of context. But you know, just the whole corporate, you know, profit-driven, out-of-touch rich guy image, and they were there to personalize him. But what was funny to me is Romney has made no effort since then to personalize himself. You know, so he was on the campaign trail, and he told that voter that, you know, if she wanted to start her own if it was he or she, borrow money from your parents. You know, like not everybody can borrow money from their parents, and so it was odd to me that he somehow still seems incapable of like following through and demonstrating to us that he is the guy that all the people in his church testified that he is.
Yeah. I also think that there's this issue of, you know, I grew up around a lot of conservative Republican people who in the way that they talk about politics, you would not gather that they have much empathy at all. And yet, in their personal lives, even in their business lives, they show a tremendous amount of empathy. And, you know, I mean, I'm thinking of someone, I won't say their name because I obviously haven't asked permission beforehand, but who is a very conservative Republican who basically thinks that the culture of dependency argument against generous social welfare is correct, but who has also on multiple occasions taken poor people into his home and, you know, gone out of his way to help with medical bills of employees of his, who really does live out the, I guess, personal charity part of that belief set, right? And so I think it's a little bit fraught to try and understand someone like Mitt Romney and assume that, like, his personal generosity somehow maps onto the empathy that would come across in his public policy. I just think that they're different things. Like, whatever you think about the merits of all of the surrounding arguments, they're different things, and trying to conflate them is going to mislead you as often as it helps.
Yeah, but I guess, you know, the person you describe, I think that's very typical of conservative Republicans who think that there shouldn't be a government-provided social safety net because they think that people and churches and houses of worship will provide those things out of an impulse to help their neighbor. And while I'm heartened to know that that's true, I also think that that's not always going to do the trick, that obviously there are going to be people who don't have someone in their lives or even a stranger in their lives who would do that for them. And some people's financial or other problems can be so vast that they, you know, it's difficult for someone to find somebody to help them out through that difficult time.
Right.
And so I think that to translate that sympathetic or empathetic impulse into policy, I think that you have to be able to demonstrate. I mean, I guess, you know, if you want to run on the Republican ticket and say, look, you know, I think that we're just going to rely on the goodness of Americans to help their fellow citizens, you could run on that. But I think that there are too many people. I mean, that's the Tea Party message, I guess. But I just think that there are people who are looking to hear a little bit more about what else is there aside from hoping that my neighbor is going to help
like
me out.
I certainly think the American public supports a much bigger safety net than the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party. And like I said, I just think that there's a danger of, like, I think we agree that there's a danger of conflating someone's personal behavior on that issue and like their political behavior on that issue. But I would also say that I think this cuts both ways in the Romney in debating Romney because he, you know, his policy record in Massachusetts suggests that he does care about having a social safety net and making it work. His health care plan in Massachusetts and making that a priority, you know, does indicate that, that he is okay with that sort of thing or even affirmatively wants to make it work. And certainly his rhetoric now is different on those issues. And I don't know actually how he would come down as president on safety net kind of issues. It's actually totally unclear to me.
Right. Well,
and also in Romney's personal life, right, he's been both praised for being empathetic and attacked for not being empathetic. You know, like there's that story about, well, you know, there's the he likes to fire people line, and there's the line about how he, or the story about how he allegedly bullied someone, like held them down and cut their hair when he was in prep school or something like mm-hmm. that. And so I think that both the church stories about Mitt Romney, like helping fellow Mormons, and the stories about him, like taking pleasure in firing people, I tend to discount both of those things very heavily and try to focus on, you know, what agenda is he proposing and what has he done in the past. And unfortunately, that doesn't get you very far because
right.
The agenda he's proposing has changed so many times. And
well, I think
and
that's
a
fundamental
so
problem that he has is that still, we even after all these efforts that they made at the convention to let us know more about who he is as a person, that we still don't, because you know you can take those church member testimonies with a grain of salt, and you can also take you know as you do well you take the story about the prep school bullying with a grain of salt, and you sort of put that all together, and you're still up in the air about what kind of person he is.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that my best guess about what kind of person Romney is that he is the ultimate management consultant.
Right.
He comes into a situation and he assesses it and he assesses how he thinks that it should be fixed, but he doesn't straightforwardly say how he thinks it is going to be fixed. He looks around and he kind of looks at all the stakeholders and thinks about what they want to hear and how he can package himself as the person that they want to solve the problem. And so there's like a double game going on, right? I think in his heart of hearts, Mitt Romney thinks that he is a very competent person who really wants to help America and help to fix things. I don't think that he is seeking power for some, you know, weirdly malign reason that other politicians don't have, right? But at the same time, I think that he doesn't think that part of his moral responsibility as a candidate is to be forthright about what he really believes. And I realize that this could just as easily describe almost any politician, but even more so with Mitt Romney. He just takes that to a degree that isn't very common, I don't think, in American life. Or maybe he's just particularly bad at faking authenticity. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know what it is about him that makes him bad at that. I feel like also when he tries to tell a story that you think might provide some history or background about him, it ends up telling you kind of the opposite of what he might have intended, or maybe some unintended consequence. I'm thinking of, I was in Florida covering the primary, and I heard him give this speech where he was talking about when he worked at Bain, they helped out Staples. And mm-hmm. he told some story about how, you know, he went, you know, he didn't sit in a fancy office around like a fancy conference room table, like that they went to this, the office of the client, and they had to sit in these like uncomfortable naga hide chairs. And it just struck me as like hilarious, because on the one hand, he was trying to tell you that he didn't sit in a fancy office and he was just helping this regular old company out. But then he had to right. talk about how uncomfortable the naga hide chairs were. And it's sort of like, well, what, you know, what did you, or you're trying to tell us that you were, you know, not fancy, but then you complain about the not fancy, or you make it seem like the not
right,
fancy
yeah,
is
yeah,
good
yeah.
enough for you. So, you know, I feel like he's, he hasn't, I mean, if for someone who's been in politics as long as he has, he doesn't have that gene for that skill that politicians have of like being able to relate to people where they are.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's pretty accurate. After surveying the Republican and Democratic conventions from afar, what was your takeaway about the kind of substantive difference in the message that the two parties were sending?
Well, I actually thought that the Republicans were offering people a kind of dark place. I know that they were trying to project that they were the party for the future, that the Democrats don't have control over the economy and they don't know what to do to fix the economy, and we'll fix the economy and everything will be great again because everybody will be able to live the American dream. But I just felt like it was kind of like gloomy, and obviously, like, I'm not a conservative, and so the idea that their economic platform would lead to prosperity and success for the middle class didn't ring true to me. So maybe that's why I kind of viewed it that way. I thought that the Democrats did a really, really good job of I think the Republicans, I should add, probably did do a really good job of reaching their base. I thought that the Democrats did a really, really good job of reaching their base by showcasing a lot of new faces, a lot of old familiar faces. You know, the Bill Clinton thing was genius. I thought that they did a really great job with, you know, being affirming of gay and lesbian people and really not running away from their new gay marriage stance in their platform. They were,
right,
you know, very full-throated about their support for women's rights, for reproductive rights. They didn't shy away from that at all. But then they stumbled a little bit, I thought, with the last-minute platform changes and reacting to sort of the Fox News faux outrage about the word God being missing from the platform. And so,
right,
I thought that was unfortunate because it sort of, again, signaled this idea that they are worried about being seen as anti-religion. So they have to, you know, like, I mean, really? Like, you really think that any serious person is going to think that you hate religion because you took the phrase God-given potential out of the 2008 platform, but you otherwise had all these affirmative statements about faith? It just seemed really stupid and short-sighted. And also pissed off a lot of delegates. And then I thought having Cardinal Dolan at the end was just kind of a really, really odd move because it just signaled, I think it signaled that they still don't know what to do about religion, that they would have Nancy Keenan and, you know, Cecile Richards and Sandra Fluck, and then have Dolan come and kind of step on all of that and make it seem like, well, you know, like that's all that stuff that they just told you about, that's against religion. They didn't take time to show that, you know, there are people for whom this is not against their religion, that it's, you know, that it's consonant with their religion to support these things. So,
right,
I thought they stumbled a bit on all of that, but that overall, I thought that it was a very base motivating convention. I have no idea about the coveted swing voters.
Yeah, I don't know how the Democratic reaction will play either. Since you focused on it, I'll talk about my thoughts on the Republican convention. One of the things that struck me was the foreign policy that they put forth. You know, insofar as there was discord at the Republican convention, it was mostly about Ron Paul voters who were upset about certain rules changes and who wanted,
right,
to make their presence felt at the convention.
And I think that anybody who didn't anticipate that happening wasn't paying attention to what the Ron Paul camp was doing all along.
So they played this video that was a kind of a tribute to Ron Paul, but focused literally entirely on his non-foreign policy critiques. And then Rand Paul was able to get a speaking slot at the convention, and he has pretty profound disagreements with Mitt Romney on foreign policy, but
right,
basically didn't mention any of them. And, you know, he's trying to both increase his influence within the party and also try to retain his father's supporters, and he's in a very tough spot, and I'm sure had to get his speech vetted. So as a Rand Paul fan, this doesn't, you know, sour me on him particularly. But it was notable to me that they basically didn't allow Rand Paul to voice any of his foreign policy critiques. And then they trotted out John McCain and Condoleezza Rice, who both gave relatively interventionist speeches that sort of harken back to the Bush era and the so-called freedom agenda, and basically made the case that Obama has abandoned this and we needed to return to it. And, you know,
a lot of people on the left who would say that Obama hasn't abandoned it at all, or at least the, you know.
Yeah, I mean, when they talk about the freedom agenda, they're talking about what they mean by that is intervention in Iran, intervention elsewhere in the Arab world. They, in their view, the American military has not played a great enough role in the Arab Spring.
Okay.
It's a pretty sweeping vision, a very neoconservative vision of what U.S. foreign policy should be. It's completely out of step with what voters want. I think it's completely out of step even with what the average Republican wants, and reflects more of a sort of inside the beltway power of this interventionist foreign policy that's more kind of defense establishment and hawkish interventionist, basically. So that was one thing about the Republican convention that I guess it didn't surprise me, because this is what Romney has been basically running on in his foreign policy. He's been
right.
Hawkish and bellicose.
He has neoconservative foreign policy advisors. It's not a surprise.
And not just conservative foreign policy advisors, but you know,
like neocons,
Josh
right.
Bolton anyway. So that was one thing that surprised me. And another thing that I noticed about the Republican convention is, of course they were making a largely negative case against Obama. And the biggest thing that they hit over and over again, it was on signs, it was in so many speeches, was his "we didn't build that" comment, or "you didn't build that" comment. And it was basically the centerpiece of the whole convention. I mean, just again and again and again, it hit that point. And by the time that the Democratic convention rolled around, I think most people probably forgot about it. I don't know that, even though it seemed rhetorically effective at the time as kind of a zing, and it definitely fired up the base, I don't know that it advanced any sort of argument or change in perspective that was beneficial to the Republicans in the long haul. And then the last thing I would have to say about it is that I think that Democrats this year, I don't agree with some of their domestic issues, but I do think that they're able to describe what they want to do in relatively straightforward terms, and that those actually are the things that they want to do. I think that Paul Ryan especially is just... Romney and Ryan have put themselves in a position where they kind of have to mislead on their domestic agenda. And I think that this is especially true in two ways. One way is that they keep talking about how the deficit is a big problem, and a lot of conservatives think it's a moral imperative to tackle the deficit. And yet at the same time, they're talking about the possibility of war with Iran, and they're talking about cutting taxes, including
right.
for
Right, and where would
earners.
That money come from, right.
And if you look at all, and they're talking about no tax increases, right, and they're talking about increasing the military budget too. So you just can't do all those things.
And they aren't specifying how they would do it. Several sides of their mouths, because they haven't figured out, the Republicans love to talk about the three-legged stool. And I think that they haven't really quite figured out, well, how are we going to make all three legs of the stool happy at the same time, given that the economic policy leg of the stool wants to hear us say that we're going to cut taxes, and the national security foreign policy leg of the stool wants to hear us say that we're going to be tough and possibly go to war with Iran. And, I'm trying to think what the,
right.
how the social conservative leg of the stool is thinking about those particular tie-ins. But I think that the social conservative leg of the stool is going to be in favor of massive tax cuts, and also a muscular militarized foreign policy. So I think that they haven't figured out how they're going to reconcile that. But I think that the Democrats could hit that more than they are, because I think that when you think about how much money we've spent in Iraq versus economic troubles at home, what voter is going to want to replicate that? I mean, I think that obviously there are some, but I think if it's posed in those sorts of, in that sorts of terms, it might bring it to light a little bit more what they're really proposing.
I think if Romney and Ryan are elected, fiscal conservatives are going to be very disappointed in their record and feel misled by it. I think the other thing that they are not being completely straightforward about is Medicare. And that's a little bit trickier because Paul Ryan, in his long-term, outlook on what the United States should do, wants to basically voucherize Medicare.
Right.
And have pretty substantial cuts to Medicaid. In this campaign, he's running, they're attacking Obama for cuts to Medicare, which is partly misleading, because what Obama is cutting isn't Medicare benefits, but reimbursement rates. At the same time, the reimbursement rates could conceivably have an effect on the quality of coverage. But you would never know from their Medicare attacks that Ryan's long-term vision is to have pretty sweeping, significant changes to Medicare. Now, it's also true that Ryan's long-term benefit or long-term Medicare take that Romney has sort of signed on to isn't going to kick in for 10 years, right? And to say I'm going to be president for 8 years and the most controversial part of my agenda is going to kick in 10 years later, it's disingenuous. You just can't make things happen like that, right? There are going to be new Congresses. There's going to be a new president.
Right.
If that's your plan for reforming entitlements, then you have no plan for reforming entitlements. And so I don't know what would ultimately happen. I suspect that they just wouldn't do much to Medicare and that they wouldn't be able to push through voucherizing Medicare if they were elected.
Even if the Republicans won a majority in the Senate, you don't think they'd be able to push it through?
I don't. I don't think that Republican legislators want to push it through. And as far as I've seen, in 2010, they talk about entitlement reform. But then in 2010, they ran on a kind of Medicare campaign. The Democrats are going to take away your Medicare. In 2012, they did the same thing. They're doing the same thing. I think that they see it's a political loser. I could be wrong. Maybe they would try and actually pass the totality of the Ryan budget. But nothing in the past 10 years experience has shown me that they're serious about doing this. They always talk big about deficit reduction and shrinking government, even going back to Reagan, and they never succeed in doing it. So this could be the exception. Every election cycle is different. Every time is different. But if I had to guess, I would bet against them succeeding in doing that.
So what would they do then? Get nothing done?
They would cut taxes, I think, and the deficit would go up a little bit, and they would maybe tweak healthcare policy in a little bit more of a free market direction, maybe.
So they wouldn't fulfill their pledge to completely repeal Obamacare?
Well, that is the thing that they have committed the most to rhetorically in a way that it seems impossible that they could get out of it.
Right. I mean, that's what the base is expecting.
It is. And I don't know exactly what that means, completely repeal. Like, I don't think that the base demands that they repeal the fact that kids can stay on their parents' insurance until they're 26. And I don't think that the base demands that they repeal the part where insurance companies can't deny you for having a pre-existing condition. I do think that the base demands that they repeal the part about an individual mandate to buy health care. And a lot of healthcare policy wonks would argue that you can't separate these things or the whole system comes down and collapses.
Mm-hmm.
So So, you know, maybe they find a way to finesse it and repeal some of the unpopular parts of the legislation and keep the rest. Maybe they just don't do it. Maybe they just fail to do it. I don't know what they do. But they put themselves in a tough spot regardless.
It seems to me like all of the scenarios you're describing are prescriptions to make the base go crazy, that the base would be so angry and furious that the things that they thought that they were electing these people to office to do didn't get accomplished.
I mean, the Republican base is tricky to figure out, right?
I guess I'm talking more about the Tea Party, the real...
Well, the Tea Party is tricky to figure out, too. Yeah, I mean, they're tricky to figure out, right? Because the Tea Partiers talk as if they are... They speak as if they demand purity and will compromise on nothing less, but they're also nothing if not loyal Republican partisans. And, you know, as evidence, here they are supporting Mitt Romney, who they all disdained in the primaries right now that he won the Republican Party's nomination. They told us again and again during the primaries that you can't trust this man.
Right.
And here they are enthusiastically speaking
up
on his behalf.
Well, he's more trustworthy than Obama, who might be a Muslim and wasn't born in America and all of that.
And I should say that it's notable, right, that during the Republican National Convention, the Tea Party went completely unmentioned, and this did not draw cries of protest from...
You mean unmentioned by speakers?
Yeah, I mean, if it was mentioned at all, I missed it. Certainly it wasn't a substantial presence. If it was mentioned, it was only in passing and in a way that I didn't hear.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty striking, right, that the Tea Party wasn't a group that they felt that they had to reach out to and placate. They reached out to neoconservative defense thinkers more than they reached out to the Tea Party in that convention.
Well, did you get the sense from talking to delegates that people were unhappy about that?
No, I didn't hear the Tea Party mentioned in my conversations with delegates. And, you know, that's actually, I should say as one caveat, that naming Paul Ryan as vice president was an outreach to the Tea Party base. And so that is true. But Paul Ryan is also popular with other conservative Republicans. It's not like just the Tea Party thing. But even despite Ryan, I expected that I was going to hear talk about the Tea Parties and maybe a little video tribute to this protest movement that helped them win back. You know, it didn't happen. And Tea Partiers seem to be okay with that. I haven't heard an outcry about it. So, I don't know. If Romney and Ryan win, I have no idea what kind of domestic agenda they will ultimately end up pushing through.
Well, that's comforting, I guess.
I don't know. Is it comforting or not?
I was being sarcastic.
So you mentioned that you'd noticed something absent at the Democratic convention, and that was any mention of drones.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it became a thing because there were journalists questioning or raising questions about it. I don't think that the Democratic speakers weren't going to bring that up. But I think it's another thing where, you know, there are some moral questions raised by the use of drones to kill civilians or the collateral damage of, you know, people who are nearby who might be killed by one. So I think that, you know, again, to me, the strenuous efforts to speak to people of faith and to talk about values and things like that, you know, I mean, there's one constituency of religious advocates that the Obama administration hasn't given much attention to, and that's religious advocates against torture. And, you know, the Obama administration decided not to prosecute anyone who had been involved in the torture program. And so I think, you know, I mean, obviously, like all politicians are, there's not a lot of honesty about real moral issues like that usually, but it just sort of, and, you know, obviously Republicans talk about values a lot too, and it often has to do with, reproductive or sexual issues than it does something like torture or drone strikes. But, you know, I think that for the Democrats, you know, there is an actual real live religious religiously based movement opposed to torture, and right. they've paid no attention to it.
Yeah, it's especially striking given how big a deal Democrats made in 2004 and 2008, especially 2008, about the moral case against what the Bush administration was doing, and the argument that it's immoral to detain people indefinitely, it's immoral to torture people, it's immoral to kill innocents, and so to have all of those things disappear from the Democratic National Convention this year was pretty disheartening to me. I cover a lot of civil liberties issues, and I was one of the people at the convention who was trying to ask Democratic delegates about drones and covering some of the Occupy protests and the Code Pink protests, and in fact, in one of the videos about Obama's accomplishments last night, they showed a picture of Anwar al-Awlaki, and noted assassinating him. He was, for those who don't know, the American citizen who was killed in Yemen by an Obama drone strike. And that was particularly striking because, on one hand, when Obama gets questioned about his death, he acts as if he's never confirmed that he was responsible for it.
Right. Well, he also acts like he never confirmed that there is a kill list, even though
right.
people in administration, yeah. his administration
course,
had confirmed
yeah,
that.
Yeah, his administration has been leaking about it, but it's striking that that not only is his administration leaking about it and some people talking about it on the record, even as he's denying that they ever do so, it's even in the campaign video that's aired in prime time.
But that's part of we're tough on terrorists and we need to flex our muscles about that.
Yeah.
Which, I think it's in large part a reaction to Republicans portraying them as being weak on defense and foreign policy issues. But there's a place where you can go where it's too much.
Yeah. And I think that this is such an under-discussed issue in the country, not only moral issues about our foreign policy abroad, but also civil liberties issues about what's happening at home because of what I regard as war on terror excesses. And I guess one little anecdote about how invisible these things are now. Like I said before, this is the first time that I've covered conventions. And I got to Tampa at the Republican National Convention. And I was stunned I expected there to be very tight security. I've never been in an environment that was anything like this. And I don't think that the Republicans are necessarily to blame for the difference in security at the RNC and the DNC, because it's often a combination of local police and the Secret Service that are running these things.
Right.
But whoever's responsible for it, I don't know if you're familiar with the game Call of Duty, which is one of these like realistic war video games, and they often will be set in like a post-attack United States where you're like walking around as a soldier in the streets and there's barricades all around and military everywhere and enemies to take out. And, except for the fact that there were no enemies shooting at us, this is what Tampa felt like. There was a freeway that was shut completely down that ran kind of through downtown, and that was empty. And there were multiple levels of barricades, and there were helicopters, like three different helicopters, constantly hovering in the air just looking down on you. And then most striking of all was that there were lots of people in military-style uniforms. I don't know if they were I don't know if they were National Guard, if they were actual military. I don't think they were National Military, or if they were police in military garb. But the effect was to make it feel very militarized. And, there were submachine guns, and there were and people in fatigues. There was less of people in fatigues in Charlotte for whatever reason. But to me, it's really unnerving and really something that we don't want to do, to put to like militarize these kinds of situations that are supposed to be these civic democratic gatherings.
Right.
And there's a certain irony to me that, there's been a lot of talk since these shootings in Colorado and elsewhere about the Second Amendment. And the Republicans, of course, are the party of conceal and carry. And I don't come down hard one way or another about exactly the level of gun control that we should have. I do believe that the Second Amendment gives you right to own guns, and where you draw the line, I think reasonable people can agree on that, but disagree on that. It's striking to me, however, that the Republican Party thinks that you should be able to walk into a movie theater, right, with a concealed weapon, that basically everyone should be able to do this.
For a church.
And yet, as people were walking into the Republican National Convention, you couldn't take an apple or a banana. You couldn't take whole fruit into the convention hall, right? And there's just like a crazy disconnect when those two things are both true. And I don't know how anyone could possibly resolve them.
Yeah. Well, I think there, and I have to go in a few minutes, but I just think it's disturbing on the one hand that it is militarized in this way to give people the sense that they're not safe, or that maybe the public officials in the convention hall wouldn't be safe without this kind of security. At the same time, it's precise, as you say, you know, the Republicans support people being able to carry guns pretty much anywhere they want and carry them in a concealed way, and to basically let anybody buy a gun without any restrictions. Yet, if that wasn't the case, would you need to have this militarized zone outside the convention hall that went so far as to, you know, take people's apples and bananas away? It just seems like, you know, maybe if we had, you know, fewer guns in people's hands, then we wouldn't have to worry about these things so much.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe. Either way, we went a long time in the United States with without having this kind of excess militarization. And, you know, I don't buy that 9/11 changed everything.
Right.
Especially when you have the president, in fact, successive presidents now, with Bush at the end of his term and Obama now, both talking about how successful their foreign policy has been and how they've decimated al-Qaeda and how America is a lot safer now.
Well, if that's the case,
why do you keep ratcheting up the security? If we're safer now, let's ratchet it back down again.
Well, I mean, was it clear at all who it was that they thought that they were protecting the conventioners, the delegates from? I mean, did they think that it was a foreign threat, a domestic threat, or that just wasn't clear? It was just a...
I mean, I imagine that the people in charge are think that it's both. And I think it legitimately is both. I mean, look, these are targets. I'm not saying that there should be no security there. You know, there should be security. But surely there is some imperative other than security. And you know, just to cite another example, even miles from the convention hall. So I was covering some of the Occupy protesters, and the presence at both the RNC and the DNC was relatively small. I think there were probably, 40 people maybe 60 at the absolute maximum. And they would be marching down the street in Tampa and in Charlotte as well. I saw not an Occupy protest in Charlotte actually, but like another group of demonstrators that were like pro-gay marriage demonstrators. Mm-hmm. And in both cases, these protests were people marching around city blocks that were a couple miles in one case and maybe half a mile in the other case from the convention outside the secure zone. And the police outnumbered them literally. There would be like groups of police riding on bicycles in like almost like a Tour de France style peloton, like, and they would be, there'd be a couple of groups of these police, and they would be just riding around the streets and surrounding them. And in Tampa, there were police on foot that were marching in like in formation. And it just, to me, you know, again, if you have a march going through downtown, I don't object to a few police officers being there in case someone smashes a window or in case something turns violent, you know, perfectly fine. But at some point, you get enough police there where you're sending the signal that to march on the street and exercise your right to peaceably assemble, that there's something wrong with this, that there's something presumptively criminal about this.
And or
that
dangerous.
And it's dangerous.
Yeah.
Right. And that's a bad signal to send to the people who are watching. In both cases, the police, as far as I saw, conducted themselves professionally, and that's to their credit. So I'm not maligning them. I'm maligning the people who sent them there in such numbers to send this kind of disturbing signal.
I think it's disturbing, too. Well, this is a great conversation. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. And, yeah, you're going, but it was fun.
Okay. Take care.